majority should have their discussion in public on the floor of the House.
Will they? As lawmakers prepare to convene in Juneau, open caucus meetings are in question. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, January 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaskans push for answers on future healthcare coverage.
We would like to know what the plan is to replace the Affordable Care Act and ensure that there isn't going to be a massive gap in coverage.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you have an opinionated teenager in your home who thrives on proving a point, check out the Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future Scholarship Competition organized by UAA's Seawolf Debate Program. More than $10,000 in prizes will be awarded. Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future gives the next generation of Alaskans a voice in the direction of our state. Contest details available at debatingakfuture.com. This message sponsored by Seawolf Debate.
Last year, when most Democrats were in the minority in the Alaska House of Representatives, they held regular caucus meetings that were open to the public before voting in sessions on the House floor. Most of the Democrats who were out of power last year will be in the majority this year. But it's not clear whether the majority caucus will hold those pre-session open meetings. APRN and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
Representative Paul Seaton is a Republican who was in the majority last year and remains in the majority after he switched caucuses this year. He says the new majority will have an open approach.
The majority generally doesn't hold pre-session caucus. You know, if a smaller group of legislators want to get together and talk, that's one thing. But the majority should have their discussion in public on the floor of the House.
The new majority caucus includes 17 Democrats, 3 Republicans, and 2 independents. Coalition spokesman Mike Mason says it plans to meet in the coming days to decide whether it will hold open caucus meetings. Seaton said early on Wednesday that he does not expect the new majority to hold pre-session open meetings. Later in the day, Mason said the caucus hadn't decided yet. After being told Seaton's remarks, incoming House Minority Leader Charisse Millett said she sees a contrast between what the Democrats did in the minority and what Seaton said the new majority would do.
The Democrats are the ones that actually screamed the loudest about it, you know, being a violation of having a closed caucus.
Millett is an Anchorage Republican. She says last year's Republican-led majority held weekly meetings to discuss strategy, but they didn't decide the outcome of votes. Millett says that means they didn't violate the Open Meetings Act. In fact, the Alaska Supreme Court ruled the state's Open Meetings Act doesn't apply to the legislature, and in 1994, the legislature added an explicit exemption for itself. Millett doesn't oppose closed meetings, but she says it would raise concerns if the Democrats changed course.
They've done a lot of philosophical bending so they can be in the majority and hold power, right? You know, any time that you have a group of people willing to compromise their core beliefs to get power, I just don't see a real good outcome of that.
Juneau Democrat Beth Kurtula led open caucus meetings when she was House Minority Leader from 2007 to 2014. She says it fit in with the state's traditions.
It's a hallmark of the Alaska legislature that actually its business is done in public, and so much of it is transparent, you know, compared to other states.
Kurtula added that closed meetings are appropriate on rare occasions. She says the majority caucus members are finding their way. Neither caucus has decided whether their caucus meetings will be open or closed. Millett says the Republican minority will discuss it at a retreat this weekend. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
As a presidential candidate, Donald Trump repeatedly promised to repeal Obamacare and replace it with something great. Early this morning, the U.S. Senate took an initial step toward repeal. APRN's Liz Ruskin asked Alaska's 2 senators how they're getting on with creating the replacement. What they described is still in the formative stages.
Good afternoon, Senator Murkowski's office, please hold.
Senator Murkowski's office, thank you for holding.
Senator Murkowski's office.
The phones were ringing this week at Senator Lisa Murkowski's Washington office with calls about Trump's cabinet nominees and also the Affordable Care Act.
I understand, ma'am, and I'll certainly pass along the message for you to the senator today.
I will definitely pass that along, okay?
The senator says she's well aware that due to the Affordable Care Act, some 17,000 Alaskans now get their insurance through expanded Medicaid and 18,000 by policies on the individual market, most of them subsidized.
It's a small number, but it's a number that we need to make sure that we're listening to, that we're responding to.
The specifics of that response aren't yet clear.
Medicaid expansion, is that something you want to keep? Are you committed to keeping that?
Well, it is absolutely a key part to this discussion.
Beyond that, she didn't directly say. She, like the rest of the Alaska delegation, wants to keep parts of the ACA, like the coverage for pre-existing conditions. She wants to dump the mandate that everybody get insurance. But Murkowski acknowledges that risks an imbalance where only high-cost patients would buy coverage.
We're going to have to figure out where those pay-fors are and how you can ensure that you get enough healthy younger people to participate.
Yeah, how do you?
Well, you make your health care more affordable in the first place.
One idea Murkowski has is to require price transparency so patients can comparison shop for knee surgery like they can for shoes or tires. Murkowski says each state will need different solutions.
You ask the natural and easy question, well, you know, what is the plan? But I think if we get hung up on one plan, I can tell you that so many of the things that are being discussed right now is expansion.
What's the plan is actually the name of a campaign launched by UAA students. Poli-Sci major Mark Simon says he's alarmed that Congress is already taking steps toward repeal.
We would like to know what the plan is to replace the Affordable Care Act and ensure that there isn't going to be a massive gap in coverage.
Senator Dan Sullivan says he doesn't think Congress will immediately change or drop the subsidies that help most people who buy insurance on the exchanges.
We're not looking to pull the rug out from people who have relied on this law, even though the law is not working.
But eventually, do you think the plan will eliminate the subsidies?
I don't have an answer to that right now.
Sullivan says Congress has to make major changes and soon. He points out that only one insurance company is now serving Alaska on the exchange, and the cost of plans has shot up.
To do nothing right now, would be irresponsible.
The House is expected to vote Friday on the budget measure that starts the repeal. It instructs Senate and House committees to come up with repeal bills by January 27. Earlier this week, Murkowski backed an amendment to extend the deadline until March. The sponsors dropped that amendment, but Murkowski says she's been assured the timeline isn't set in stone. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The U.S. National Cross Country Ski Championships wrapped up in Utah today with an abbreviated skate technique sprint competition. The race consisted of a single time trial over a 1.3-kilometer course at the 2002 Olympic venue at Soldier Hollow. Canadians swept the men's podium with Alaska Pacific University team racer and former UAF Nanook Logan Honeman a close fourth. Other top Alaska finishers included APU teammates Reese Honeman and David Norris in 9th and 14th, respectively. Top Alaskans in the women's race were also APU skiers. Chelsea Holmes finished 6th, Jessica Yeaton was 10th, and Becca Rorabaugh came in 13th. Alaskans posted numerous top 10 results during this week's competitions, which are used to help select athletes for upcoming international competitions, including World Championships. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, how a man with a domestic violence record was allowed to travel with a gun to the Fort Lauderdale airport.
It's very sad to say that what happened in this DV case is very par for the course that we see every single day.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Anchorage and Fairbanks to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
A week after a mass shooting at the Fort Lauderdale airport, questions remain about why an Anchorage man with multiple domestic violence incidents and a documented mental breakdown was allowed to transport a handgun across the country. But much is unknown about Esteban Santiago. And as Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, law enforcement officials say Santiago's brushes with the law only look like warning signs in hindsight.
In a court hearing in March, Santiago gave short answers to Judge Gregory Motika as he took what's called a deferred sentencing agreement in a domestic violence case.
You understand you're giving up all those rights?
Yes, sir.
No one's forcing you to do this?
No, sir.
And you're not under the influence of any medication, drugs, or alcohol at the present time?
No, sir.
The agreement had Santiago plead to a lesser charge if he agreed to complete an anger management course and not engage in any violent behavior. The original charge, laid out by a municipal prosecutor, was from an incident 2 months earlier.
Mr. Santiago was with his girlfriend, GP. Mr. Santiago forced his way into the bathroom, breaking the door in the frame in the process, and hit GP on the side of the head.
Several times last year, Santiago had contact with police stemming from accusations of domestic violence. At a press conference in Anchorage a day after the shooting, Police Chief Chris Talley laid out a chronology of those encounters, none of which led to any new charges.
On October 21st, 2016, a physical disturbance allegation of strangulation. Officers investigated and no probable cause was established for arrest.
This came just weeks before Santiago went to the FBI and complained of mind control by government agencies, characterized by law enforcement as a mental health crisis and leading to a short stay in a treatment facility. At that point, the police held on to a handgun Santiago had with him, although they ultimately returned it a month later. There's speculation it was the same weapon he used when he allegedly opened fire at the airport, shooting 11 people. And while in retrospect the domestic violence incidents and breakdown might look like red flags, officials say that is a very different view from how things looked in real time.
It's very sad to say that what happened in this DV case is very par for the course that we see every single day.
Seneca Thino is Anchorage's municipal prosecutor. She says there are a lot of reasons police wouldn't have been able to make an arrest amid accusations of strangulation or assault. For one, police aren't able to review someone's full record while they're responding to an incident, which can make it difficult to spot a pattern of abusive behavior. And two, officers are trained to consult with a prosecutor over whether there's enough evidence to ultimately make a case down the line. Thino says without probable cause, there's really no recourse available to law enforcement.
We'll either say, we've got a lot of other cases we're going to put our resources into, so don't make an arrest now. Just document what happened, and there's not a lot else that we can do.
Does that happen a lot with DV cases?
It happens all the time with DV cases. Domestic violence cases are some of the most difficult, in part because they happen in the privacy of a home most of the time. And there oftentimes are not witnesses, and frankly, that's usually by design.
Thino doesn't see anything exceptional in Santiago's police record and describes the mental health crisis as coming out of the blue. Santiago went to police to retrieve his gun on November 30th, but they didn't hand it over for reasons that APD is still not made clear. But on December 8th, he got it back. And Thino says while this might look reckless in hindsight, firearms are treated like all property, same as a backpack or a phone. Unless it's being held as evidence, police have to return it.
They don't get to look back and say, well, yeah, you're kind of sketchy, right? You've had some things and we're not quite sure what's going on, and so we're going to hold on to your stuff because we're not comfortable with you. They don't have the legal authority to do that, regardless of what other incidents they've had with that person.
Even amid a mental health crisis, there's no law that would have kept Santiago from reclaiming his firearm unless he'd been officially declared mentally ill by a state judge. And that is a very high bar. Alaska doesn't have any unique laws when it comes to gun ownership, just the federal standards. Under those laws, anyone convicted of a domestic violence assault is prohibited from owning or transporting a gun. But when Santiago pled down to a delayed sentence on a lesser charge of creating a fear of injury, that federal provision wasn't tripped. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Five cases of HIV in one Bristol Bay Area village have been reported to health officials. The small outbreak, or cluster, began with one individual case reported in February of 2016. Two more were reported in October and November, and two additional people tested positive as officials began investigating. There was concern that the HIV might be tied to needle sharing from the epidemic of opioid drug use. Dr. Kathy Haindman from the Kanakanak Hospital in Dillingham says health officials do not believe that was the case.
HIV is spread through sharing of blood and body fluids. It could be happening by drug use, but it does not appear to be so in this particular group of cases. This particular group of cases seems to be associated with sexually transmitted vectors.
According to a state report, all five of the HIV cases in this cluster involve men who have sex with men. Needle sharing was not reported as a risk factor, but alcohol and drug use did likely lead to unprotected sexual activity. Dr. Haindman says HIV is treatable, and she recommends people at risk get tested often. Transmitting HIV is also preventable.
Use protection. The only protection that's available for sexually transmitted cases is wear condoms every time. Every time.
Health officials say limited access to health care and health education, as well as patient concerns about stigma and confidentiality, can be barriers to routine testing. Over the past 5 years, an average of 28 newly diagnosed cases of HIV were reported in Alaska. The Interior Gas Utility and Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority have approved a memorandum of understanding to forward the Interior Energy Project. The state-funded IEP is aimed at increasing the availability of gas in the city as a less expensive and cleaner burning alternative to other fossil fuels and wood. The project has a lot of moving parts and is behind schedule. But as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the MOU is a key step.
The Memorandum of Understanding was approved in separate meetings this week by the Interior Gas Utility and Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority boards. The MOU lines out terms for the North Star Borough-created IGU's purchase of Fairbanks Natural Gas from ADA. ADA bought the formerly private utility as part of the state-funded Interior Energy Project to increase availability of gas in Fairbanks. IGU General Manager Jomo Stewart says the $58 million purchase will be financed over 50 years.
The interest rate on the loan itself will be 0.25%. There will be a deferral built into this loan of 15 years where no interest will accrue and there will be no principal or interest payments.
Stewart says the 15-year deferment will allow time for the IGU to build a customer base beyond the one established by Fairbanks Natural Gas in the city's downtown area. The MOU also paves the way for access to state financing for gas processing, transportation, storage, and distribution infrastructure. Stewart says the next step involves specifically lining out how that development will happen.
Really nail down the process, get the dollars flowing, and get the things constructed that eventually bring those benefits of all this work to the front walls of the homes and businesses in Fairbanks.
The Interior Energy Project has long targeted delivering gas to Fairbanks customers at a price equivalent to $2 a gallon heating oil. Stewart says the latest price estimate slightly exceeds that target due to added costs.
There's a little bit built in on customer charges and probably a little bit for operations.
According to ADA, finalization of the MOU documents is due by March 31st, but contingent on securing a gas supply to feed increased demand in Fairbanks. ADA is negotiating a supply contract with a Cook Inlet producer for the gas, which would be moved by truck or rail to Fairbanks. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the 2017 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms available at bpteachers.com. If you're a rural Alaska resident, consider applying for a seat on the Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council by Friday, February 3rd, 2017. Applicants with knowledge of regional subsistence uses, customs, and traditions are needed. Council meetings serve as a forum for subsistence management. More at 1-800-478-1456. This message sponsored by your Federal Subsistence Board and the U.S. Departments of the Interior and Agriculture.
It may be called the National Petroleum Reserve, but this 23-million-acre chunk of federal land on the North Slope didn't see a full-scale oil development until 2015. As this new era begins, the Bureau of Land Management is adding another layer of protection to this vast, sensitive area. But depending on who you ask, the agency is either asking too much of oil companies or not enough. Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk has more.
Last month, at the Bureau of Land Management's lease sale for the National Petroleum Reserve Alaska, a pattern emerged. The oil company ConocoPhillips was winning again.
Submitted by ConocoPhillips Alaska.
And again.
The second bid submitted by ConocoPhillips Alaska.
And again.
Buying ConocoPhillips Alaska Incorporated and
Conoco picked up close to 600,000 acres in the National Petroleum Reserve last month. The company is behind the first oil project in the reserve, and it's steaming ahead with two more developments there. But ConocoPhillips is clashing with its new landlord, the BLM. The federal agency is working on new, tougher requirements for oil development in the NPRA. Oil companies are already required to minimize their footprint as much as possible, like by restricting traffic when caribou are nearby. But Stacy McIntosh, BLM's Arctic office manager, explains some impacts are impossible to avoid. For example, an oil development could overlap with the subsistence hunting area used by the people who live nearby.
There's always going to be residual impacts because a development is going to remove a certain amount of acreage from a community's harvest area.
That's where this new strategy comes in. BLM will expect companies to compensate for the unavoidable impacts of oil development. For example, an oil company could build a road to provide access to other hunting areas. But Conoco strongly opposes the new approach. In a letter to BLM, the company called a draft of BLM's strategy a polarizing document that has major flaws. The company says there are already hundreds of requirements in place to protect the National Petroleum Reserve. Conoco also says BLM isn't taking into account the benefits of oil development, like job opportunities for local communities. A spokeswoman for ConocoPhillips declined to comment beyond the letter, but plenty of others were willing to speak out.
We're in a situation where the bar is constantly being raised, and it's becoming ever more challenging in terms of economically exploring and developing the resources in NPRA.
That's Carl Portman, Deputy Director of the Resource Development Council in Anchorage. BLM's new strategy also has political opponents, like Senator Lisa Murkowski, who asked the agency to withdraw it altogether. But environmental groups say the protections are important. If anything, they want the BLM to go further. Nicole Whittington-Evans of the Wilderness Society says BLM should take into account how oil development could affect the climate.
Clearly, oil and gas development and the burning of fossil fuels will have an impact on climate and will create a carbon footprint. And we believe that these types of impacts need to be addressed by the BLM.
BLM hasn't yet released a final version of the strategy. So as ConocoPhillips goes ahead with a new era of oil development in the National Petroleum Reserve, the federal government is still wrestling with how to manage the consequences. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
A Southeast lawmaker introduced a bill this week to help Alaska ferries meet state pollution control rules. It would also exempt new ships from a law requiring a percent of construction spending go toward art, Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Technically, most ferries and small cruise ships operating in Alaska are out of compliance with state water discharge rules. That's because regulations exempting them from more stringent rules designed for much larger cruise ships ran out a little more than a year ago. Department of Environmental Conservation Division of Water Director Michelle Hale says it took the agency a while to figure that out, so it's not fining ferries or other small ships. Instead, she says it's seeking a legislative solution through a bill introduced before the session starts.
It'll reinstate that language that will then provide for ferries and small cruise ships to use a different method of treatment than is required by the large cruise ships.
Hale says that method, which has been in place for several years, requires far less equipment and staffing.
So the best management practices plan requires them to collect samples and to run their treatment systems at an optimal level, but they're not required to meet the more stringent limits of the large cruise ships.
She says the requirements apply to ships carrying from 50 to 249 passengers. That's counted by the number of beds, not including upper bunks, cots, or foldouts. So while some ferries carry more people, the bed counts are within the limits. Officials say without the pollution control exemption, costs will increase.
We're having trouble with the Marine Highway as it is with capital expenditures.
Sitka Republican Bert Stedman introduced Senate Bill 3, which would reinstate the small ship exemption.
I would imagine it'll be a lightning bolt subject matter when we get it in the system, and I'd like to keep it focused down on trying to keep our smaller fleet going, particularly the Marine Highway.
Another provision of Stedman's bill would exempt three new ferries from the state's 1% for Art program. That uses part of construction costs to purchase painting, sculpture, and other creative works for display on Marine Highway vessels. Ferry spokesman Jeremy Woodrow says that provision would reduce the cost of two new Southeast shuttle ships and a replacement for the Tustamina.
The department does support SB 3, which would allow the department to use existing artwork that actually has been taken off of the Taku, which is in permanent layup status, and we have also removed art from the Chinega, which is in long-term layup status.
That concerns Juneau Democratic Representative Sam Keto III, whose district includes three other ferry port cities.
The arts community is a very active and economic contributor to our Southeast community. I would like to see Southeast artists be able to provide art for our public facilities, including the Marine Highway system.
Senate Bill 3 is one of several dozen pieces of legislation pre-filed by Alaska lawmakers. Sponsor Stedman says the idea came from discussions with state officials. He says the bill is a rough draft. Like all legislation, it will undergo changes if it gains traction and advances through the legislature. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Zachariah Hughes and Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, and Dave Benninger in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettisworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line.
The University of Alaska Southeast is open for business to all Alaskans. 2017 is your year to finish a degree and increase your earning power with online courses in business, accounting, and management. Explore the options online at uas.alaska.edu/SOM. This message sponsored by UAS.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.